volunteer training is a program created to of the Citizens Climate Education and Citizens Climate Lobby to help our newer volunteers and emerging group leaders connect with each other around the world and empower you to achieve your larger goals for climate advocacy. This week's topic is the economics of carbon fee and dividend policies. I'm your host, Tamara Staten. I am CCL's Education and Resilience Coordinator and also get to be our regional coordinator for the Greater Pacific Northwest. And I really appreciate you joining us. So if you want to follow along with tonight's slides, we are at cclusa.org/economics-CBT. So we have three learning goals for you this evening. If we have done our job well, Paul and I are going to help you understand how a carbon fee affects supply and demand and how it ripples through the economy. You can even do the fingers because it's really fun to say ripples and do that with your fingers. Number two, we're going to help you understand the three parts of the carbon fee and dividend policies that CCL supports. And number three, we hope that you are going to learn about the Energy Innovation Act by the end of the evening. So let me take a minute to introduce Dr. Bernstein, Dr. Paul Bernstein. He has led the construction of, the operation of, and the reporting of analysis from economic models used to study energy and environmental policies. So you're in the right place with the right guy. Let me just say that. He specializes in developing economic models applied to such diverse fields as climate change policy, alternative fueled vehicles, fuel markets, and electricity generation, and then synthesizing the results of these models into reports for government agencies, lawmakers, trade organizations, and corporate executives. And now he spends his time generously volunteering for us, for CCL, and for you, volunteers, to, as well as educate us. In addition, he serves as a Hawaii State co-coordinator, lives on Oahu, and is also his liaison, to his representative and one of his senators. So I will pass the mic to Paul in just a few moments, but let me tell you what our plan is for this evening. Pretty straightforward. We're gonna dive into some basics of economics, do a little economics primer, as they say in the UK. And then we're gonna talk about the three parts of our flagship policy, as we like to talk about it, fee and dividend, the fee, the dividend, and the border carbon adjustment. And then we will have an overarching time for questions. We will make time for questions at the end of each one of those areas, the fee, the dividend, and the border carbon adjustment. And you can just use, you know what? We have a Q&A feature on Zoom these days. So if you see Q&A at the bottom of your Zoom screen, or if you click the More button, you can use the Q&A feature to drop your questions. If you don't know what the Q&A is, you can just use the chat and I'll check there as well. So before we dive into the economics part, I just want to remind you, or perhaps educate you, on CCL's expanded policy agenda. The CCL policy of a carbon fee and dividend, the CCL policy of a carbon fee and dividend and border carbon adjustment that we're going to be talking about tonight remains CCL's foundational and flagship climate solution. Basically, we continue to support this policy as we have over the last 10 years. And if you want to learn more about the other policies that we're not going to be talking about tonight, check out the link in the chat. We have a fantastic interactive training on that. And with that, I think it's your turn, Paul. So don't forget to unmute.
So welcome, everybody. Appreciate you making it to this afternoon where I am, or this evening, probably where most of you are, chat here about some economics around the carbon fee and dividend policy. And so talking about, so let me start with where we are today, and sort of that will imply why we need a policy like carbon fee and dividend. So first, the IRA subsidies and regulations will only get us so far. Forecasts are for 7 to 10% reductions from where we would have been without the policy. And they're an expensive model for developing countries. Second, the United Nations process is voluntary, lacks enforcement, and most countries have not lived up to the modest plans. So this goes to the Paris Agreement, right? We need something that has some teeth. Third, much more needs to be done as emissions are rising and current policies and institutions don't get us far enough. So, the pandemic helped in as far as emissions, but we've seen the emissions recover above 2019 levels now. So how can we find the policies that will bring about the necessary emissions reductions to ensure a livable planet for generations to come? And I hope at the end of this presentation, you'll feel that the carbon fee and dividend policy with its border carbon adjustment is a policy that we need. So first I wanna just touch on the topic of economics and why it's valuable for analyzing. Oh, sorry, I'm supposed to control the slides, my bad. Okay. Try this again. we want to talk about use economics to help steer us towards the policies that we should look at. And so simply, economics can be broken into microeconomics and macroeconomics. And microeconomics is simply, looking at supply and demand. And it's just the study, as it says here, of how to allocate scarce resources for production, distribution, and consumption, both within households and collectively across consumers. So the supply curve is just a curve, and made this little graphic here, that the supply curve is just showing what the willingness is to sell something, right? The higher the price is, the more willing somebody is to sell something. Demand is the downward sloping curve there that just showing the willingness to buy something, right? The lower the cost, lower the price, the more you're willing to buy it. We're not going to really cover the diagrams shown in here aren't really going to cover macroeconomics, but just for your information, macroeconomics is kind of the study of the economy as a whole, estimating what gross domestic product will be, things like that. Okay, so what we have here is just a new labeling of an X and Y axis. So before we had price for cell phones, here we're going to be looking at fossil fuels. So we have the price for fossil fuels on the Y axis, and we are the vertical axis, and we have quantity of fossil fuels on the X or the horizontal axis. So this is so far no different than what we had when we were talking about the cell phones. And here is a demand curve for fossil fuels. So just like with the cell phones, what this is saying, just looking at it qualitatively, don't need to worry about any numbers, is that the higher the price, the less consumers are going to demand to fossil fuels. As the price declines, consumers will continue to demand more and more fossil fuels. And just as we had with the cell phones, there's a supply curve out there, right? There's producers of fossil fuels. And at low prices, they don't want to supply that much, right? It's expensive to produce, and there's only so much that's available at low cost. But as the price goes up, they're willing to supply more and more. They're willing to undertake more and more challenging drilling operations, for example. And so where these two curves cross, there we go, gives us the point that it gives us the price on the y-axis, the price there, that fossil fuels will sell at the same price that the producers are going to sell it for. And there's this price P, I know, very creative, and the label Q for the quantity there. Okay, so if you can think about, okay, so this is the market we have now. And I think we're all part of CCL, part of this call, because we think that Q is far too great. that we need to somehow reduce the quantity. So what could be done to reduce the quantity of fossil fuels? What could we do in the marketplace? What could regulators do in the marketplace? So one thing they could do is they could decide to tax the fossil fuels or put a fee on fossil fuels. And so if they were to do that, then now the producers, there's an additional cost to the producers to sell their fuel. Now the fuel providers are going to have to pay this tax for each unit of fuel they want to sell. That tax drives up their costs, and that's why we have this supply curve that's at a higher level. And we can think about this as the tax is taking into account or partially taking into account the social cost of carbon. In other words, the social costs that are involved with supplying fossil fuels. So these social costs include pollution, right? It includes global warming, includes ground level pollution, the health impacts, what have you. So if this tax isn't in there, the producers, all they're doing is they're selling their fossil fuel at the cost it is for them to produce it, plus some profit. Whereas with this tax, we're trying to capture the fact that, well, no, there's not just the private costs, there are these social costs involved, right? That we're all experiencing now with warmer temperatures and all sorts of other environmental issues. So the figure is just showing that now we move to this new equilibrium point, this Q tax and P tax. So the Q tax being below Q. So by imposing the tax, we've lowered the amount of fossil fuels that will be purchased in the marketplace, right? And at the new price P tax, you can imagine if we keep increasing this tax, that supply curve keeps going up and up and up, and we start continuing to achieve our goal of reducing the amount of fossil fuels consumed in the economy. So just, you know, kind of the summary here that putting the price on fossil fuels raises the cost, leading to lower demand. People talk about this in terms of internalizing the externality, where that externality is basically the difference between the private and the social costs. So, okay. So had the figure, we say that we put on this tax and we reduce emissions. Well, we reduce fossil fuel consumption, therefore we do reduce emissions in the economy. Okay, but how does that really take place? What's going on? We showed the nice little figures, the schematic there and what have you. So just in words, we're going to see what happens is some of the costs, which could go back to the figure, but are going to be borne by the industry and businesses, utilities. But some of those costs, they're going to pass on to consumers, which is exactly what we want, right? We want consumers to see the price increase so the consumers will change their decisions. And putting this increase on fossil fuels will lead to a movement away from fossil fuels, some to conservation and some to substitution. And so the next three slides, I'm just going to go through kind of some representative examples of what will be happening, what would happen on the consumer side and what would happen on the producer side. And as I said, just looking at a couple examples to help make it a little bit clearer what was behind the first figure showing the overall supply curve changing. So, and what's going on the demand side, if you will. So when we're looking at the households with the, if we take vehicle purchase decisions, for example. So again, same type of figure, price of gasoline vehicles, or really I would say cost of ownership, really, of the gasoline powered vehicles on the y-axis or the vertical. The quantity of gasoline vehicles that are purchased on the X or horizontal axis, And so again, we have our demand curve for, you know, what people are willing to pay for gasoline powered vehicles, or the overall cost they're willing to incur for, you know, both the purchase and operation of it. And then the supply, what the cost, the, you know, essentially what producers are willing to supply it at. So now, if we put this tax on gasoline, what essentially we can think, we could think about it in two ways, but I'm going to think about it this way because this is the way we've been looking at it. The essentially the cost of the vehicles is going to increase. So the supply curve, again, we're going to get this new curve that's representative of the tax on gasoline. And so what we're going to get away, what we're going to get here is on the consumer side with this example, is consumers are going to move away from purchasing gasoline powered vehicles. And we could show another figure, kind of draw the picture again, showing that some of that's going to be a substitution towards electric vehicles. So anyways, again, just simple example showing some of the consumer changes in consumer behavior that this policy will elicit. And now if we move to, well, sorry, and just summarize in words here that, so we impose a tax on gasoline, the cost of ownership of the gasoline powered vehicles increases. So demand is going to fall. So the consumers are going to, as I said, look for alternatives, whether it's electric vehicles, it could be higher efficiency, higher efficient gasoline powered vehicles, or it could be some other non-vehicle mode of transportation, whether that's bike, bus, walk, et cetera. So looking on the producer side, let's take the example of the electric utility, since there's been there's been a great deal of focus here, right? That one of the things that's talked about is we apply this policy of putting a carbon fee on and we're going to move to electrification. But electrification is only going to be good if we move away from fossil fuels. So if we look at the what's going on with the electric utilities, if we think about the inputs into their production, we have capital. So that's their buildings, if you will. We have labor, their employees. We have energy, right? So that's composed of fossil energy sources, coal, natural gas. We have non-fossil energy inputs. So that's wind, solar, nuclear, hydro, et cetera. And we have materials. And so if we put the price on fossil fuels, we put a tax on fossil fuels, we're going to get this switching away from fossil fuels to non-fossil fuels, indicated by the nice big arrows there. And then just to complete the picture, we get some also some increase in capital, labor, and materials that's you can think of as representing energy efficiency. So the utilities also, in addition to switching technologies, will also try to become more efficient. All of this in an effort to reduce the amount of fossil fuels, right? To lower their costs, to avoid as much of this tax as possible. So let me go one other example on the producer side. So if we look at more of a classic manufacturer rather than an energy produce, you know, electric sector that produces energy, same idea. You can think of this as an automobile manufacturer, but it could be a manufacturer of basically anything. And again, just in a very aggregated sense, looking at the four inputs that we're talked about before, the capital, labor, energy, and materials. So here now the energy, this company could look at fossil energy. So maybe it uses gas for heating its buildings or whatever. It could consider non-fossil energy for heating. So, you know, people talk of, you know, biofuels or what have you, or electricity. And so again, what's going to happen if we put the tax on fossil fuels? I'm guessing you folks can draw the arrows yourself here by now. So if we look at this, we should see fossil energy would decline, the non-fossil energy for heating, what have you, would go up, and electricity would go up. So these companies are likely to move to electrify more. And I'm doing this under the assumption that the electric sector is also decarbonizing, right? So if you're getting your power from an electric utility that only has coal and has no way to decarbonize or what have you, then this is a bad example. But let's just assume that for the sake here, that the electric sector is decarbonizing. So it's going to be better, less costly for these manufacturers to move away from the fossil fuels into either electricity or non-fossil energy. Whoops. Sorry. So just to summarize, what happens if we implement such a policy? We should see the energy cost increase, the fossil energy cost increase. We should see emissions decline. And then in terms of the macro economy, what various studies have shown is that money, as you would expect, would be steered towards clean energy and efficiency. The studies find actually there's really not that much inflation that occurs from this policy. There will be naturally a shift in jobs to the green sector, if you will. And overall for the economy, there have been a couple studies of the European Union, which has carbon pricing, and has found almost no impacts on the gross domestic product of these countries. So a couple of questions now. So if we were to impose this carbon fee, what do we want it to look like? So that being, what do we want the starting value? How should it transition over time? What pollutants should it cover? And where should we apply the fee? So in terms of the fee, we could have many different paths as shown here. The one that we're supporting in the Energy Innovation Act is the green line. And the problem with, I would say, the red line at the top is that it starts out at quite a high price and probably would bring about too much of a shock to the system and potentially cause a lot of instability and potentially really hurt households as they're trying to adjust. The other red line is somewhat ridiculous, right? This is from a business standpoint. It makes it very hard for a business to figure out what technologies to invest in, what to do if the price is going all over the place, which is a bit of an issue with cap and trade programs. In terms of what to regulate, it makes the most sense if we're going to use the market to regulate the greenhouse gases, which we can easily measure. And then last, in terms of where to apply the fee, on the left is the idea that the fee would be applied at the lowest possible level. So it'd be applied at the household, applied at the pump. But there are millions of households, there's millions of gasoline stations, et cetera. It'd be much easier, and there are far fewer entities to regulate if we apply it upstream, so where the fossil fuels are extracted. Again, exactly what the Energy Innovation Act has, that we apply it as far upstream as possible, so to make the regulation as simple as possible. So exactly what you brought up. So we collect this big pot of revenues from administering this tax. So what's the best use of those revenues? So we could take those revenues, we could give them back to households, we could pay down the debt, we could use them for social programs, we could use them to reduce pre-existing taxes, we could use them for clean technology. And Isabella, so under social programs could be worker retraining to help people make the transition. So I think for CCL, one of the main things we want at CCL is, I think, one of our core tenets is we want the policy to protect low and middle income households as best as it can. And so what the Energy Innovation Act does is returns all these revenues back to citizens, back to citizens in equal shares. And the reason for doing that is what study after study finds is that is the most progressive way to distribute the dividends. So for example, reducing pre-existing taxes generally is going to help the, well, depending on how you do it, could often just help the higher income tax earners over the lower income. Other issues of refunding are just simply not as progressive. In terms of, I guess, well, I'll speak for myself, Isabella, I personally would be okay with a policy that gets rid of dividends going back to the top 20%, let's say, and using that for worker retraining or other social programs. I think, though, that there's this issue of striking a balance between the ease of a policy, if you will, or the simplicity, which the Energy Innovation Act goes for, namely just give all the dividends back to people and give them back in equal shares, simplistic, easy to implement. And the issue that once you start opening up the pot of money towards other things, then where do you stop it? And where do you, you know, everybody's got their pet projects or what have you. And I'm not saying there's a right or a wrong answer, just mainly trying to give what I see as a justification for the way the Energy Innovation Act is written. And Tamara, I don't know if you want to add anything there.
No. Just go ahead and keep going and we'll get to that more in questions. Thanks, okay. Paul.
Okay, so just want to speak a little bit about the Energy Innovation Act and what this means in terms of if we are to give back all the revenues that are collected back to citizens, less an administrative fee to just that, to administer the program. So as I mentioned, that all the dividends would go back to households, less this administrative cost. Every adult would get a full share. So that's regardless of income level, right? Makes absolutely no difference whether whether it's Jeff Bezos or any of us on this call here. We all would get the same amount, assuming that you're all over 18. If any of you are under 18, then I'm sorry, you only get a half a share. Talk to your parents about getting the rest. So what does that mean? So for a family of four, if emissions go along the trajectory that it's been forecasted, in year three, that equates to roughly $2,000 per household. In year five, it'd be a little over $3,000 per household for a family of four. So sorry, four meaning two adults, two children. And by year 10, it's almost $4,000 per household. Eventually, this money is going to come back down, right? Because this policy is going to bring emissions down. So households will be getting less and less over time. But this is a relatively gradual trajectory, both on the upswing and on the downswing. So this smooth transition from year to year means they're not massive shocks to the system and allows households to, you know, plan for, you know, to manage their finances more easily. So reasons to support the Energy Innovation Act, or as we say, carbon fee and dividend. First, durability means that if this policy were to get through, it should stay in place. It's hard to imagine, just as with Social Security, that once people start receiving the checks, that lawmakers are going to decide to take those checks away if they want to keep their job. Second is the simplicity of this. Somebody put in the chat about how difficult it is, the difficulty of quantifying carbon emissions. So we already account for oil production, gas production, coal production. So these quantities are well measured. There's an easy factor that goes from the actual fuel to what are the carbon emissions that occur when the fuel is combusted. So carbon emissions are relatively simple to administer. And then in terms of giving the money back, the IRS doesn't have to worry about, okay, what's your income level? Who gets what have you? Everybody just gets the same amount back. So file a tax return, you're eligible for the dividend. It's transparent, which is great for businesses. Businesses know exactly what the cost of this policy is. They know what this is going to do to fossil fuels. This differs greatly from command and control policies, where they don't know what the price is, what the cost might be. So businesses are can more easily plan. It's both efficient and effective in the way it takes advantage of the marketplace. There are 3,600 plus economists who signed a statement saying this is the most efficient and most effective policy. And sort of towards the effectiveness part or efficiency, it's just low in administrative costs. It's taking advantage of the current regulatory infrastructure. Not much new needs to be created for this policy. Okay, so there are three elements that we mentioned at the very beginning to the carbon fee and dividend policy. There's the fee, there's the dividend, and then last, there's the border carbon adjustment. So I want to quickly describe what it is and why it's needed. So let's consider this example that there's a domestic producer of apples, locally produced apples, and there's apples coming from New Zealand. And before this policy is in place, let's say the apples go for $3, US local apples, and the New Zealand apples go for $2. But because of shipping costs or whatever, once they get to the US, let's say they're kind of similar in cost. So people are somewhat indifferent between New Zealand apples or US apples. So what happens if the US places a price on fossil fuels? So you put in the chat if you want, you know, what's going to happen to the price of US apples? And if it's only the US that's applying a price on its apples and New Zealand is not, what's going to happen to the price of New Zealand apples? So the price of the local apples or the domestic apples are going to increase because now it's going to cost more for the fuel used to produce apples in the US, but the apples in New Zealand are going to stay at basically the same price. So what's the effect of this on the demand relative to when this policy wasn't in effect? Is the demand for US apples is going to go down and the demand for New Zealand apples is going to go up. So this isn't exactly what we want. We don't want to implement this policy that hurts our domestic industries in favor of foreign industries. So what is it that we can do to counteract this effect? So the idea, that's exactly what a border carbon adjustment would do. The idea here with a border carbon adjustment is it would place a fee or a tax on imports based on the amount of carbon emissions associated with the production of those goods in that country. So now the New Zealand apples would now also incur sort of this dollar fee, if you will. Excuse me, the US apples incurred when we first put this policy in place without the border carbon adjustment. So now we put the border carbon adjustment in place, the New Zealand apples now go up $1 to $3. And so what happens now with the demand for apples relative to what we had without the border carbon adjustment? By placing the border carbon adjustment, the US apples now, the demand is somewhat restored for them. The demand for the New Zealand apples goes back closer to where it was before the policy was ever in place. And the policy meaning that there is no carbon fee and dividend. So the, if you will, kind of the first column there, we return to the demand levels that were more similar to what was in the first column. So just quickly, I'm just going to go back here. In the second column here is we place just carbon fee and dividend, no border carbon adjustment. The demand goes down, the US increases for the imports. We place the border carbon adjustment. The demand is somewhat returned to the where it was in the first column. So basically the border carbon adjustment is just that. It's to adjust this differential that is brought about by the carbon fee and dividend policy, or by the carbon tax. So it's to make it so that the US industries are to levelize the playing field again when this policy is put in place. And so one more slide on some basic economics. So this ties back to the little figure with the apples, if you will. So on the left-hand figure is looking at supply and demand for the domestic good, whatever that might be, it was apples before, but whatever, and the imported good. So this is a case where there's no policy in place, no carbon tax, no carbon fee and dividend. And this is where the market is trading. So with the blue dots is where we are. If we go ahead and we put on the carbon tax in the US, just the carbon tax, then what happens is the cost of production goes up for the US goods, the demand for the domestic good. So this is in the US, the demand for domestic good is going to decline. And there would likely be an increase in demand for the imported good because of this. If we put on the border carbon adjustment, then the cost of the imported good goes up and the demand for that good is going to fall. And then the last piece, kind of in a different order than what we presented, if we give the money back to households, we increase or we kind of restore their wealth, if you will, to some degree. And so now they can demand more at these higher prices. They have been given money back. And so with this demand, some of this quantity that they'd cut back on because of the higher prices, they can now go ahead and demand a higher level than they would have been if they didn't get this dividend back. So just kind of a simple example to show that giving the dividend back to households helps restore some of their purchasing power. And at the low and the middle income level, the vast majority of households would actually see their purchasing power increase. So I'll stop.
Thank you, Paul. That is awesome. You can also go through each of the trainings to log your trainings in the log your training section, or you can go through the action tracker to do it as well. And with that, I just want a huge thank you. Go on over to the forum, cclusa.org/forums, to post your fantastic questions that we weren't able to get to this evening. You can also email Paul directly, paulbernstein2004@yahoo.com. He will be much better at answering your questions, your policy economic questions, than I will. But I'm available for you as well. So thank you so much, everybody, for joining us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram @CitizensClimate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration.
Like what you hear? Recommend us to your friends and make sure to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us show up on other listeners' feeds. Feel free to pass on any suggestions for future episodes in the comments as well.
And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.